a double rainbow. And maybe excited is an understatement, because he's totally in awe of the rainbow. And we watched less than half of the video, and it's funny. It's funny watching someone get so raw and over the top in their reaction. But I wonder if you go home and watch the whole video, if you've watched it before, I wonder if you kind of get it. Like, it is a really big and beautiful rainbow, and he's alone out in the woods, and he comes out, and there's this huge rainbow out in the sky, and it's all for him. It's something huge and beautiful and powerful breaking into his world. And I wonder if you felt that way before about nature or even about a rainbow. I wonder if you felt that way before. And did you notice when he finally gets some words out of his nonsense, he says, what does this mean? What does this experience that he's having mean? And kind of surprisingly, it's a question that the Bible, that our passage today, takes seriously. What do rainbows mean? Our passage is like a rainbow. It breaks into the mundane clouds of our world and lifts up our gaze. In this epilogue to the Noah story, the story wants us to see that there is a fracture in the human heart and that it is mirrored in the heart of God. And so, in many ways, the story of the flood in the Bible is a restart. It's Earth 2.0. God uncreates the world. He brings the water back over the land. He uncreates the people. He uncreates the birds and the animals and everything. People had gotten so bad that God said, no more. God starts again with a man named Noah. And he's a righteous man. And so we're kind of optimistic about how this kind of sequel will go. This should go kind of well, right? Starting again with a righteous man. But, you know, sequels don't have the best track record. Often a sequel is kind of a company trying to squeeze the last few dollars they can get out of a franchise. You know, like the Lion King 2. Do you know they made a Lion King 2? Or sometimes you kind of wish you could forget a sequel. I really loved the first Matrix film, but they just kept making more and more sequels and it got worse and worse and worse. But our hope is that unlike The Matrix and unlike The Lion King 2, that Earth 2.0 is going to be kind of good. Humanity 2.0 should be kind of good. With Noah, we're hopeful that this is going to be one of those rare good sequels, like a Godfather 2 or arguably The Empire Strikes Back. And it starts off good. Noah makes a sacrifice to God in verse 20 of chapter 8, and God is pleased with it. In verse 21, God smells it. It's like, you know, when you step out of your car at Bunnings and you just get hit by that sausage and onion smell. The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma and said in his heart, never again will I curse the ground because of humans. And so in the story, things are going well so far, but there's a sense throughout this whole passage that everything is not quite right. Things are good, but as we continue, it's like there's kind of an eerie score playing underneath the story as we go through. Things are a bit off, and God goes on, even though every inclination of the human heart is evil from childhood. Even though God has wiped the slate clean and started again with a righteous man, humanity hasn't changed. Along with the lions and the zebras and the other animals that God brought in the ark, preserved with them was the evil of humanity from Earth 1.0. And God goes on, and it gets kind of positive again. And God gets kind of positive again. He says he won't destroy everything again. There'll be no more reboots. God breaks into a short poem promising order on the earth. The chaos and order that the earth had just experienced will give way to order. In verse 22, God says, as long as the earth endures, the times and the rhythms of life can be relied upon. He brings to mind all the rhythms that structure kind of a rural or kind of ancient life and promises to provide them. And it's interesting, as an aside, just how very insulated we are from all of these rhythms here in the West. You know, I'm vaguely aware that there's kind of seasonal vegetables and fruits. Like, sometimes you go to buy strawberries and they're like a little bit more expensive than other times, but, you know, you can still buy them. And, you know, I can hide in my air-conditioned house all summer long. And, you know, even the nighttime, I can delay the nighttime with lights as long as I want. And we're kind of free from all these rhythms of life that God talks about in this poem. And I wonder if there's a loss there. I wonder if both in terms of our sanity as humans, that there's a loss there, but also in terms of our experience of God's kindness, his grace that he promises here. And I wonder if, as an experiment, we could kind of reconnect with those rhythms from time to time. Go outside in the cool and experience the cool of an evening and notice the shortening and lengthening of the day. And it's not the main thing here, but in a small way, by doing that, we see into the heart of God. And the tone continues, and the tone is good. It's a return to the order that we saw in the first few pages of Genesis. And just like in the creation story, in this recreation, God blesses the new man. God blesses Noah and his sons. In chapter 9, verse 1, it says, "Be fruitful and multiply, increase in number and fill the earth." And even though this whole section from verses 1 to 7 is a blessing, it starts to get a little strange as a blessing straight away, because it's good things mingled with less good things. It's a more compromised and at times pessimistic blessing. Have a look at verse 2. The blessing outlines a new and tense relationship with animals. "Fear and dread of you will fall on all the beasts of the earth and on the birds and the fish and all the animals." It echoes the kind of dominion that humans are supposed to have over the animals in the Garden of Eden, but also it sounds a little bit like the curse on the serpent too, the enmity between the humans and the animals. And so, having saved all the animals in the flood, God gives the animals to humans to eat. And don't get me wrong, I love to eat meat. Like, I know Jesus is the biggest part of Christmas, but, you know, a really great thing about Christmas too is kind of the menagerie of animals that you get to eat at the Australian Christmas table. I love to eat ham, and I love to eat prawns and chicken and turkey, and that's a big part of Christmas for me. But, and so I get that this is a generous provision of God here. I get that it's a generous provision, but I wonder if you see how this provision is kind of a compromised blessing. This doesn't feel quite like the good order of the original creation. There's a tense relationship with animals and humans where we are sustained at their cost. Their blood is spilled for us. And it feels different to the kind of tenderness that you imagine as all the animals come to Noah on the ark and as he sends out the birds and they come back to him. It's not that same tender, close relationship. And so it's a good blessing, but with kind of an eerie undertone. And the blessing goes on to foreshadow the tense and broken relationships on the earth between humans as well. And so if our hopes are set up here for the new earth with Noah, this section brings them way down. Verses 4 to 6 anticipate a world where tensions give way to murder. God says life is not to be shed lightly. Anyone who takes a life is accountable to God. "And for your lifeblood, I will surely demand an accounting. Even the animals, I will demand an accounting from every animal and from each human being too. I will demand an accounting for the life of another human being." A human life is deeply valuable to God, because all humans bear the image of God. It doesn't matter what you think someone's worth is. Every human life is precious to God. The investment banker, the homeless man on the street, the politician, the old man, the beautiful baby, people who have disabilities, they are all precious to God, worth up to your whole human life. Our human life is not valuable because we think it's valuable, because of the arbitrary value that we give to it, but because God has made us all in his image, which is something that no human can ever lose. And we have this beautiful truth about our creation in God's image here. Why is this getting out of line? Outlined in a haunting context of the judgment of murder. In this blessing is a glimpse into the human future, which has not totally left behind the murderous world that we saw in Genesis 4 and 5. But it's only a brief glimpse, and as God rounds out the blessing, he repeats, "Be fruitful and increase in number, multiply on the earth and increase upon it." And then we get to the rainbow. From verse 8 to the end of the chapter, God outlines his covenant with Noah and his sons and their descendants after him. And maybe surprisingly, the covenant is also with all the animals of the earth. And a covenant is kind of like an agreement or a treaty between two parties. And God's already made a covenant with Noah before, and so Noah knows, you know, he's trustworthy, he's going to keep his promises. And God's promise is that in verse 11, "Never again will all life be destroyed by the waters of a flood." So when Noah and his cows are out in the field and they see dark clouds coming again and they're thinking, oh gosh, is this going to be another flood? God says that he's going to send a rainbow in those clouds. And when you see the rainbow, we know that God has promised to preserve life on this earth. Interestingly, the word that's there for rainbow is literally the word for like a bow and arrow, like a war weapon. And it's as though God is putting his weapon aside. It's a sign of the covenant, of his mercy on humanity. I don't know if you had a wooden spoon growing up, but in my house, the wooden spoon had kind of two main purposes. It was for stirring cakes and for hitting your bum when you've been bad. And you knew when Mum was using the wooden spoon for cooking a cake, well, that's a good, safe use of the wooden spoon. You look at the wooden spoon and you go, I'm safe from Mum's judgment at the moment. And so I think the image here is similar, but even more beautiful than a cake. We look up in the sky and see God's bow, and we know that God's judgment is being withheld. Verse 17 ends on a really positive note. A fresh start under a new covenant, a relationship with God where he would stay his hand. And so we've kind of hit the high point for this story, and it's really hopeful. But in just a few more sentences, things go bad. Verse 18 begins, "The sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth." And at that point, the narrator kind of turns to us and adds, "Ham was the father of Canaan." And maybe that doesn't mean anything to you, but to the original audience, they know because of that something bad is going to go down, because Canaan was the enemy. And so the narrator is in effect saying, Ham was from New South Wales. And sorry, it's hard to think of an example that isn't going to alienate some people in the audience here. But, you know, insert your enemy here. You know, Ham was a cyclist. Ham was from Slytherin. Ham puts pineapple on his pizza. Canaanites were both the enemies of Israel, but they're also just kind of straight up villains in the Bible. And so when it adds that to Ham, that he is trouble. That's an unintentional pun there about the ham. Presumably it's a few years later, and since they've gotten out of the ark, and Noah in verse 20, he plants a vineyard. Great. He makes wine. Excellent. He drinks the wine. Delicious. He drinks too much wine. Oh. And it's probably no coincidence here in the story that this new beginning for humanity starts to go bad as a result of more picking of fruit. And so Noah passes out uncovered in his tent. Noah is naked, and it says in verse 22, Ham, and it reminds us again, the father of Canaan, saw his father naked and told his brothers outside. And maybe you've noticed this about the way the Old Testament tells stories, but they're very minimalist. They choose careful and deliberate choices of words. You know, if this was written today, it would give us every bit of detail. You know, we get an internal monologue of each of the different characters, but notice how little we get about what has happened here. Noah was uncovered. Ham saw his father naked. And the language that's used to describe this event is kind of sexual, but it's not clear what exactly is going on here. What is clear is that Noah was exposed. When Adam and Eve realized that they were naked, they hid their bodies from each other because they were afraid of what might be done with their nudity and with what would be done with the vulnerability that it implied. Could they trust each other with themselves exposed? And here, the fear that Adam and Eve have is realized. Noah is exposed and vulnerable and taken advantage of. He is shamed by his son. You know, and his son invites the other brothers to shame him too. And while Noah lays there, unable to defend himself because of his drunkenness, his son shames him. And I think there are layers to this story that are more powerful if you come from a different culture, a kind of a shame-based culture. But we have shame in Australia too. Shame is when somebody takes something that is intimate and private of ours and is uncareful with it. You know, you tell somebody something raw and personal and then you find out that they shared it with somebody else. Shame is a big part of what happens when you break up a relationship. Listen to the kind of raw and hopeless embarrassment in this song by Gautier as he sings, "But you treat me like a stranger and that feels so rough. Now, you didn't have to stoop so low, have your friends collect your records and then change your number. I guess I don't really need that, though. Now you're just somebody that I used to know." It's so tragic. He had this beautiful thing where he shared himself with her, and now he's just somebody that she used to know. And it's this kind of shame and fracturing of relationship that Genesis wants us to see here. It's still here from the garden, naked and ashamed, but somehow worse than Adam and Eve. Naked and ashamed and seen and violated, Noah lies on the ground. But even though they're invited to, Ham's brothers, they don't join in. They go to almost comical lengths to give their father back his dignity. They took a garment and laid it across their shoulders and they walked backwards and covered their father's naked body. And it's kind of a funny image to imagine, but it's the kind of care that we want people to give to our own vulnerability. But Noah wakes up and he knows his shame. He curses Canaan and he blesses Shem. And it might seem kind of unfair if you're thinking of Canaan, his son, that Canaan cops the curse when it was his dad who did the wrong thing. But the narrator is looking far into the future to the defeat of the Canaanites by Israel, who were descended from Shem when they take over their land. And it's the first time we hear Noah speak in the whole narrative, and he attributes the good actions of Shem and Japheth to God. And we get this small glimmer of hope. The two sons had faced a test like Adam did, and for a moment they'd done well. And that's the end of the Noah story. And so the picture we get of this whole section is of hope and promise mingled with tragedy and sin. A new start, but with old problems, a new blessing, but with tense relationships and ominous warnings, and then a fresh fall back into the same state that we'd begun. And I wonder what this kind of pessimistic outlook on humanity does for you. Are you with the narrator in his assessment of what humans are like? Are you with Genesis on this one? And I say it's pessimistic, but it's far more complicated than that, isn't it? Because on the one hand, this passage affirms that humans do well. Noah is a righteous man, and two of his sons do well. And what's more, God affirms that all humans are made in his image. There is something good and beautiful about each of us that cannot be taken away. The Bible kind of stands with us and says there are amazing and wonderful things about each of us. But on the other hand, we see humanity can't get it right. In the middle of a blessing, God looks ahead to the murder that's to come. The righteous Noah, who is 600 years old, can't keep his drinking down. And despite what is truly good about us, there is something deeply wrong. And it's not a problem of individuals. It's not a problem that there are a few bad eggs out there. The contention of the Bible is that the line between good and evil runs through every human heart, through your heart and through mine. We are all fractured. And in a world full of fractured people, that means that you will have been a victim of this evil too, in small ways and in big ways. And God takes that utterly seriously. God sees you in your hurt and pain. But I hope that you see that if there is evil in each of our hearts, then there is evil in your heart too. And it's not just that we all have kind of cute flaws. You know, it's not just that, you know, you're a little bit late to meetings sometimes. It's not that kind of thing. And the Bible isn't saying, you know, that we've got these kind of interview question flaws, like, you know, how you're so dedicated to work that you don't have time for a social life. No, the assessment of the Bible here is that there is real evil in all of us. Real evil, like when you realize that you have an opportunity to shame somebody else and you take it. Real evil, like when you realize in an argument that you can really hurt somebody and you do. And I wonder if you're familiar with that inside of you. The Bible says that our best motives are mingled with evil ones, and our worst motives are perversions of good ones. And as we draw this passage together, I want to return to the small insight that we get into God's heart in verse 21. He says, "Never again will I curse the ground because of humans, even though every inclination of the human heart is evil from childhood, and never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done." The intent of man's heart is evil from youth, and God won't destroy them. This is the opposite of how the story began. The whole Noah story begins because God's assessment of humans is in chapter 6, verse 5, that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. And because of that, God sends a flood, and he picks one righteous man and wipes away the rest, and nothing has changed. The inclination of the human heart is still evil from childhood. And yet, there will be no more flood. Nothing has changed in us, but God is determined to hold together his anger at our sin and his promise not to give us what we deserve. God holds together in his heart his love and his justice, his utter intolerance of evil, and his desire to show grace towards us. And this tension that we see in God's heart, it kind of plays out throughout the whole rest of the story of the Bible. Again and again, if you read the story, you'll see that God is determined to love sinners without minimizing or ignoring their sin. And maybe if you've sat in these chairs before, if you've sung with us today, maybe you know where this tension in the heart of God is finally resolved. When the Bible story of salvation reaches its climax, God sends his son, a man whose heart is not evil from its youth, a man who does not fall, but whose blood is nevertheless shed for us. On the cross, Jesus dies and takes the judgment that we deserve. On the cross, God's love and justice come together. God sees us exactly as we are, sees the evil that we do, and loves us all the same because his son takes the penalty for us. On the cross, God is both just and the justifier. And you and me, broken as we are, can come to him and be made whole, renewed again. And I wonder if now you can see the meaning of the rainbow. What does this mean? The rainbow is this symbol from God that he won't judge the world. Not because we don't deserve it, but in spite of the fact that we do. In the rainbow, we see into the heart of God, of a God who knows what we are, knows what we've done, knows all the dark parts of our heart, but will not give us what we deserve. In the kind of weather that we're having at the moment, it might be a long time before you see a rainbow again, but I hope that when you do, you remember this story, and remember the God of this story and throw yourself before him.